You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
JPMorgan Chase had a pretty good run back during the crisis, you might remember. Now, though, the regulators are closing in. That and another installment of My First Job coming up on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 19th of August. Good to have you with us. This is Marketplace Podcast for said date. I don't know that it's the most exciting way to spend one's first day back from a week of vacation, but President Obama got right to it today at the White House, a meeting with the heads of the eight main financial regulators, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Fed, and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, to name just a couple of them. They're going to talk about Dodd-Frank and why 3 years after the overhaul bill was signed, so many of its rules have yet to be written. When rules are broken, the old ones or the new ones, enforcement and punishment sometimes follow. And of late, one bank in particular has been getting a lot of regulatory attention.
J.P. Morgan also back in the legal crosshairs.
The U.S. government reportedly looking into whether J.P. Morgan hired the children.
The feds are taking aim at J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan is facing six federal investigations or lawsuits, and it's in line to unseat Bank of America as the bank with the most legal problems out there. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark explains how it got to the top of the target list anyway.
Every few years, you get a set of headlines that sounds like this. Legal troubles continue to mount for...
Please fill in the blank with the name of a large financial institution.
In the past few years, that blank has been filled by
Goldman Sachs
and then
Bank of America.
Right now, it's J.P. Morgan. Why? Why now?
There tends to be the equivalent of what in football is referred to as piling on.
Harvey Pitt knows a few things about federal investigations of big banks. He was the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission from 2001 to 2003.
Once an entity comes under scrutiny and people are looking at its records anyway, specific problems in other areas may come to attention.
And as more problems come to attention, there's a bit of a snowball effect on the company's reputation, according to Georgetown law professor Donald Langvoort. He also used to work for the SEC, and he says when it comes to laws governing big banks, the lines between legality and illegality can be very fuzzy.
Which means sometimes you're tempted to either give somebody the benefit of the doubt or not. When the company's reputation is flying high, you tend to give them the benefit of the doubt. When the company's been dragged through a lot of scrutiny, not so much.
And when, in the meantime, the CEO of the company has been vocally speaking out against federal regulation, like Jamie Dimon has been, that might get the company a little extra attention from the feds. But Langvoort and Pitt both say the government doesn't do investigations just out of spite. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
There are reports out of Cairo today that former President Hosni Mubarak is set to be released from prison. So say both his lawyer and state media, although exactly when that might happen is unclear. Banks and the stock market there have reopened after days of violence, but dawn-to-dusk curfews are still in force, affecting local businesses. Jobs have dried up and foreign tourists have all but disappeared. And as it always does, political chaos breeds economic chaos. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, this time it's going to be a lot more difficult for Egypt to bounce back.
For all the anger that led to the revolution, Egypt's economy was actually doing all right before the Arab Spring.
Egypt was talked about as the next emerging market.
Isabel Coleman is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Mubarak put in place a number of economic reforms that led to relatively strong growth rates in the 5, 6, 7% range.
Coleman says the trouble at the time was that many people felt left out of that growth. Since the revolution, things have gotten worse, says Samer Shahada, the University of Oklahoma.
No new investment. Tourists were not coming back into the country. There were fuel shortages. Prices had gone up. The Egyptian currency had deteriorated.
The fall in tourism, he says, has affected both income and jobs. And add to that one of Egypt's long-term economic problems, costly government subsidies on food and fuel. Again, Isabel Coleman at the Council on Foreign Relations.
It's eating up such a large portion of government spending that it's preventing the Egyptian government from investing in other more productive uses of its resources.
Massive increases in aid from Gulf countries have helped shore up the Egyptian economy, but it's not sustainable.
Everybody knows what has to happen to help fix the Egyptian economy.
Reduce subsidies, says John Alterman. He's head of the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The problem with doing those things is not that people don't know what to do. It's that people don't want to do it because it costs money, it raises prices for the poor.
He says it's not impossible for Egypt to recover, but it will take years. In New York, I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
Traders met this Monday on Wall Street with a bad attitude, down arrows all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, according to the National Interagency Fire Center, 47 significant wildfires burning right now, almost 900,000 acres. Fires are getting bigger and they're getting closer. There's more housing being built nowadays in areas where fires are becoming increasingly common. Here in California alone, 2 million homes sit in high-risk fire zones. And Marketplace's David Weinberg reports that proximity comes with a very definite price.
When Richard Minnick looks at a charred landscape after a wildfire, he doesn't mourn the loss of the plants that were killed in the blaze.
I'm not crying at all. I'm saying, wow, you solved your fire problem for a while. The energy's gone.
Minnick is a fire scientist at the University of California, Riverside. He appreciates the beauty of the forests and the chaparral of his native California, but he also recognizes the danger it represents, and he doesn't think houses should be built in the wildland-urban interface. That's places where houses bump up against high-risk fire zones.
Straight ahead of me, I'm looking at solitary houses on tops of hills. It just ticks me off to see that.
Minnick drove me to a neighborhood in Riverside where the houses were surrounded by scrub oak, chamise, and other chaparral vegetation, which, to Minnick's eyes, is one big field of stored energy in a region where it doesn't rain for 6 months out of every year.
So it is a carpet of gasoline. Should be viewed as such, and people should think of it in those terms. And if they did so, they would think twice before they would want to live in a landscape that produces this kind of disturbance frequently.
As we drove back to Minnick's office, we came up over a ridgeline and saw a column of smoke rising in the distance.
So you can see where that fire is taking off there now. Yeah, it's on those, on the other side of those hills.
After my interview with Minnick, I headed straight for the smoke. By the time I got to the fire near the Southern California town of Lake Elsinore, huge flames lit up the night. The local high school had been turned into a central command station for firefighting crews, and a church was handing out free hamburgers to residents like Gary Sykes, one of about 100 homeowners forced to evacuate.
Actually, I'm kind of f***ed off for the simple fact that 10 o'clock this morning I get up, I see a fire, and all I see is two puny helicopters with hoses. Get this fire out. And let us go home to our, you know, to our houses that we paid hard money for.
This sentiment is not uncommon among people who live in fire zones. When they see flames searching towards their house, they want them out immediately. And that's exactly what happened in Lake Elsinore. More than 250 fire crews were called to the scene. They brought with them nearly 100 fire engines, along with 6 helicopters and 6 air tankers. No buildings were lost in the blaze.
In Southern California, we have a total fire suppression strategy. In other words, that means every fire will be suppressed with as many resources as we can throw at it to keep them small because of the threat to the wildland-urban interface.
Lorene Buchwald is a suppression battalion chief with the U.S. Forest Service. The Forest Service now spends more than half of its total budget on fighting wildfires.
Most of which they're spending fighting in and around structures, housing developments, and the like, not out in the wilderness areas.
Environmental history professor Char Miller is one of many critics who doesn't think the public should be footing the bill to protect homes in high-risk fire zones. And he says we're not factoring in the human costs when we build in these areas.
As we saw with the Yarnell Hill fire, in which 19 firefighters died, struggling to fight a fire that was coming close to a brand new subdivision. It's a tragedy, to be sure, but it's a tragedy of our own making.
2 days after the Lake Elsinore fire, another fire broke out 40 miles away. It burned 16 square miles in less than 24 hours. 26 homes were destroyed and 5 firefighters were injured. Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency. That means people who lost their home could be eligible for federal disaster aid. They're free to use that money to rebuild on the same plot of land where their home once stood and where seeds of chaparral plants will soon sprout from the blackened soil. Plants that Minnick points out have evolved to be drought resistant and as a result are highly flammable. In fact, they need fire to regenerate.
That combination guarantees burning. And we've had that combination of factors in geologic timescales for 300 million years. And it's not as if we're going to stop this.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you learn how to deal with people, you know, screaming at you or laughing. It was fun.
That's one way to think about your first job, I guess. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 70 points today, 0.4%, closed at 15,010. The NASDAQ off 13 points, about 0.3%, 3589 there. The S&P 500 down 9 points, 0.6%, ended things at 1646. Energy stocks stalled today. The season may have had something to do with it. Summer road trips are ending in the U.S., and oil prices fell for the first time in about a week. Apache and Marathon Oil both slipped more than 4% today. Banks also had a bad day. JPMorgan Chase withdrew almost 3%. Apple, on the other hand, picked up 1%. Share price there up 13% in the last 6 trading days. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.88%. Look out, man. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Are folks deep into their reading lists? Barnes & Noble releases quarterly earnings. The news network Al Jazeera America launches. And it's not all about TV. Tomorrow is also National Radio Day. Cool. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a drug the cattle industry uses. It's called Zilmax that helps them bulk up steers before they're slaughtered. But after some reports that some animals were showing signs of distress while on that drug, sales have been suspended, at least temporarily. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports now on life without the drug for the beef business and for consumers.
What's the difference between a steer with Zilmax and a steer without?
Roughly 30 pounds.
Lynn Steiner is a co-author of the Daily Livestock Report.
Cattle are similar to humans. You just keep eating and eventually you stop growing and you put on fat.
Zilmax changes that. It's like a get-buff drug for cattle.
Instead of putting on fat, they put on some additional muscle.
And we're talking a whole lot of muscle on a whole lot of cattle. Merck, which makes Zilmax, estimates that 70% of U.S. cattle sold to slaughterhouses are fed either Zilmax or a similar but less potent drug called Optiflex. Now, without Zilmax, feedlots are looking to switch fast. There just aren't that many untapped ways to beef up beef. Dan Schaefer is an animal sciences professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
We already, in American agriculture and in the cattle feeding industry, use all the available nutritional information that we have to maximize growth rate of cattle in the feedlot. So there is nothing that's held back.
A cattle industry without Zilmax will be a smaller cattle industry. Rich Nelson is a strategist at Allendale, Inc.
We're looking at about a total of a 1% drop in nationwide beef production from this particular issue by itself here.
Which means already high beef prices will go up a bit.
On a per pound basis, you're probably looking at maybe an increase of about 1 to 3 cents per pound.
He says one thing to watch, how much consumers care that these drugs go into making their steak. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Millions of Brits are packing themselves off to the beach this month, but all too few of them are headed for British beaches. The continent, Spain and Italy and Greece mostly, are more popular places for Brits to go. Seaside resorts in the UK have been losing out for decades, and some have declined so much that they're less vacation destinations than convenient places for the unemployed to live. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now on the phenomenon they're calling poverty on sea.
This is Jaywick Sands, a fine sandy beach along the densely populated southeast coastline of England. It should be an area of affluence. It isn't. On the other side of this seawall is a district officially described as the most deprived and troubled in Britain. Theresa Cooper is unlucky enough to live here.
People burning down buildings and breaking into bungalows. It has got a bad name for drugs, alcohol, all that sort of thing.
Is it justified?
Yes, it is.
She lives here on the Brooklands estate in Jaywick because it's cheap, and it's cheap, admits local landlord Barry Shimewell, because the properties are very, very basic.
All they are, really, is a glorified beach hut. The garden sheds. The garden sheds, that's all they are. They are a wooden shed. End of day, that's all they are.
Brooklands Estate was a once thriving settlement of seaside holiday chalets, but it's now shunned by holidaymakers. Today, the mostly dilapidated homes are permanently occupied by the poor. And just as Brooklands declined, so has the nearby resort of Clacton-on-Sea.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Clacton Carnival Sandcastle Competition. Please come and sign in at the table.
Clacton's annual carnival is in full swing with a sandcastle competition and an egg-throwing contest.
What you need to do is throw the eggs to your partner without breaking it.
Not lavish entertainment, it's true. The somewhat faded resort is past its prime. Susan Wiggins, a lay minister in the town, says Clacton has, over the years, suffered from the vagaries of the English weather and the falling cost of foreign vacations.
With the package holiday, people then decided to go abroad for their holiday with the guaranteed weather. It was actually cheaper to go to Spain for a fortnight than it was to come to Clacton for a week. And Clacton started on its decline.
Clacton's decline continued. Empty hotels and guest houses were converted into cheap apartments. And that, says community worker Sharon Alexander, has drawn even more disadvantaged people into the town.
When people are discharged from institutions such as a mental health institution or a prison or a residential unit in London, they are guided to come to Clacton because of its very cheap accommodation.
Unlike other parts of Britain, where homelessness is the problem, here it's the surfeit of cheap accommodation, sucking in too many unemployed and poor people. What's needed are jobs and investment to break the downward spiral. Work is underway improving the Brooklands estate, and there's even some optimism here. Roy Stevens, a grizzled old resident, says with its beachfront location, Jaywick is certainly worth backing.
Any of you guys out there in America are thinking about investing some good money, just invest it in Jaywick in Essex, because you're going to make yourself rich.
In Jaywick, on the southeastern coast of England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Book publishing isn't a phrase we hear all that often without dying or is dead. somewhere close by in the same paragraph. But once upon a time, running a publishing house was a prestige thing, even if it was one with a challenging business model. Boris Kochka has a new book out about perhaps the most prestigious publisher, Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's called Hot House, the book is. Boris, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Why did Roger Straus decide he wanted to be a publisher after the Second World War?
He was flailing a little bit. he came from a Princeton family, Strauss's and the Guggenheims, and
a family of some note. I mean, you know, it was they were high society, right?
Yeah, came with a lot of expectations, and you know, he figured he'd run something, but he didn't know quite what to run. I think it was really the center of culture. It was the and that's where the most important people sort of gravitated.
It was in the 50s and 60s. It was a big deal to be a publishing house. It was of note. It was worthy. It was celebrated, and then. And then the wheels didn't quite come off, but it didn't. It stopped being what it was. It stopped being the new, right?
Yeah, it was a low margin business, and it's the business that a certain wealthy intellectual class would find themselves going into. It just became less glamorous, and I think a lot of that had to do with consolidation.
What was it then about Farrar, Straus & Giroux that made it stand out in the worlds of Simon & Schuster and you know, Harcourt, Brace, Jovanovich, the school publishers, and Houghton Mifflin and all those guys?
Well, if you look back at, for example, Robert Giroux, who brought the intellectual heft to FSG, had been at Harcourt, Brace, and they had started getting into textbooks, and that's what Simon & Schuster were doing. They were getting into the most profitable parts of the industry and growing, and Simon & Schuster eventually was acquired by a conglomerate. What FSG did was remained independent and mid-sized. They actually had impact, and yet they managed to stay independent, and the only shareholders they had to answer to were essentially Roger's rich friends.
How then does FSG balance publishing the kind of, as you call them, literary high-minded works that it wanted to publish with just flat paying the bills?
Some of it had to do with that sort of cushion of collateral that Roger Straus had for so many years. Some of it had to do with chronically underpaying writers and staff. you had to have the occasional bestseller.
Hmm. How much did FSG benefit, do you think, from the personalities of its founders? I mean, they were extremely, as you say, influential in this thing and influential in the circles. Did that change the nature of this company?
Yeah, and I think that sometimes people think of, you know, marketing as a modern phenomenon or PR publicity, that drives books, and before it was all about just the quality of the book inherently. But I think with the success of Roger Straus is the success of PR. It's a slightly different kind of PR. It's more review-driven. Now, you couldn't do it without someone like Giroux, sort of the workhorse behind the scenes, making the books worth the effort, because otherwise someone's going to realize that you're full of it. but you needed to project a certain aura, and I think it's important to keep in mind that that's always been true.
Could somebody, if they put their mind to it, could they launch a publishing house like FSG today?
It would be very difficult, and I don't think it would look like FSG then or now. I think it might be online. I think it might have social elements. It might outsource editing. It might outsource marketing. I think we are looking at a totally new environment. And if I could tell you what that would look like, I would probably do it myself.
Hmm. Boris Kochka, his book about Farrar, Straus & Giroux is called Hot House, The Art of Survival and the Survival of Art at America's Most Celebrated Publishing House. Boris, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It was great.
We're counting the days till summertime is behind us, which means a lot of people are wrapping up their very first jobs. We've been asking around after those stories that people have, what they learned and what stayed with them even today.
My name is Don Holshue, and I'm a truck driver. My first job was with the Excelsior Amusement Park in Excelsior, Minnesota. It was about 16. I was hired to do the games, and my wages were 75 cents an hour. And how I got it was some friends said, well, the Excelsior Amusement Park was hiring. And so I went down with them, and it was the beginning of the spring, and we got hired for the summertime. And after a while working the games, then I moved over to running rides in Kiddyland at the amusement park, which was incredible. Well, at the time, Excelsior Amusement Park, all the major companies would have their company picnics, like General Mills, Northwest Bank,
they would come in, and these events on the weekends were just a massive amount of people. And it was a good experience because it was the first time really you got to experience different type of people when working the games and the rides. So you had this, you know, cross section of, you know, from poor kids that came in like from the school field trips and, you know, weekend, middle class. Everybody was kind of gathered together in this pit. And so you were able to, you know, see and experience different people on their level, and everybody was having fun. And so you also you learn how to deal with people, you know, screaming at you or laughing. It was fun. When I received my first paycheck, a couple of friends and I, we took the bus from Excelsior, Minnesota to Minneapolis, went to the department store, and I bought a pair of Levi's for $5.85. And woohoo, it was cool. One thing I learned is that you always show up, you're on time, and you do your job. That's it. Do the best that you can within your working hour.
Don Holshue has been on the show before, you know, usually on a cell phone from his truck driving around the Midwest. We check in with him from time to time. We want to hear your first job stories, funny, sad, shocking. Send them to us. Tweet them at Marketplace APM or email us letters@marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg gets an earful from an unemployed web developer. Said developer found a bug in the company's software, tried to report it under the bug reporting in exchange for cash program that Facebook has. Tried a bunch of times, in fact, with nary a peep from the company. So the guy hacked Zuckerberg's personal page, and while apologizing for the hack, left him a message there about the bug. Bad enough for Facebook, but then they made it worse. Since he actually hacked the site, the guy's not going to get the cash reward that you usually get if you report a bug, which honestly stinks, but hey, that's just me. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 70 points. That's almost a half percent. The NASDAQ down 13 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 dropped 9 points, almost 0.6%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.